These days, one of my favorite parts of the Sunday newspaper is the comics. And one of my must-read comics usually is Dennis the Menace. So last week you had Peanuts with John bringing the sermon, and this week you have Dennis the Menace. And I imagine most of you are familiar with Dennis. He's the little blonde-headed kid in the red overalls who is either causing or getting into trouble in one form or another. Margaret is another character in the comic strip, and Margaret, there you have a picture of Dennis and Margaret. Margaret is a redhead who has kind of a love-hate relationship with Dennis, and in one particular strip, Margaret comes up to Dennis as he's playing outside, and she's got a clipboard with her, and she says this. She says, "Dennis, I have been working on an image makeover for you. First, a new hairstyle, then a fashionably trendy wardrobe. Add a generous application of some aromatic cologne. Finally, an attitude adjustment toward a certain redhead." And then she says, "Well, what do you think?" And Dennis, without missing a beat, says, "There's just one thing I would leave out. Me." And he goes back in the house and slams the door on his way in. And Margaret then walks away and sighs and thinks to herself, "He looked so good on paper." That's kind of true for all of us, isn't it? We all look good on paper. We all can make ourselves look good on social media, you know, where we're curating our image. We all look good to that, you know, boyfriend or girlfriend in that new relationship. We all tend to look better from a distance before you get to know us. And then as you get closer, the more you learn about us, it doesn't take long before you start to encounter some of our wrinkles, some of our flaws, some of our rough edges. And those things become an obstacle to the practice that I want to talk about today. We've been in a series, kind of an unusual sermon series, where instead of doing, you know, it consecutive weeks, we've done it all throughout the year. It's called Practice Makes Progress, and what we've been talking about are some of the spiritual disciplines and habits of the Christian life that would do us well if we incorporated them into our lives. And so every month or so, we've been doing one of these practices, talking about them, and then giving you a month to actually practice the practice. And we come to another one of those this morning. And if you saw the title, then you know where we're going with this. We want to talk about unity this morning. And unity is actually both an ideal and it is a practice. And I imagine you've maybe thought about unity as the ideal, but maybe you haven't thought about it as a practice. Well, we want to talk about the practice today. You hear all over the place how divided we are as a society, don't you? And if you're like me, maybe sometimes you get kind of tired of hearing that. I mean, yes, we're divided. Yes, you know, we are polarized. But what do we do about that? You know, maybe if this sermon went viral, you know, we could change American society. But I'm going to set my goal a little lower this morning. And I want to speak to those of us who are Christians, who are followers of Jesus in this church. And if you're watching online, we welcome you, and I want to talk about what would it look like for Christians to practice unity. And here's the thing, if just Christians were able to practice unity well, and Christians throughout our country practiced unity well, it might make more of a difference in our society than we might think. So we want to talk about this practice of unity today. Let me start with why it's important. And to do that, I want to take you to John chapter 17, and I'd invite you to join me there. John 17, the words of Jesus. Let me, as you're finding it, ask you what might be somewhat of a morbid question. If you knew that tomorrow you were going to die, what would you be talking about today? What would you be thinking about today? What would you be praying about today? Well, The night before Jesus died on the cross, we know what he was thinking about, and we know what he was talking about, and we know what he was praying about, because we have this record in the book of John. And I want to read part of Jesus' longest recorded prayer in the scriptures. And we'll see what he has on his mind. John chapter 17. Begin reading with me, if you would, at verse 20. Jesus is praying here, and we jump into the middle of his prayer. He prays, "My prayer is not for them alone," speaking of his disciples, who he has just prayed for. "My prayer is not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message." So who is he praying for there? Praying for us, who follow him today. Praying for Christians throughout all time. "I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one, Father. Just as you are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. I have given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me." So we have Jesus there praying for the church, and I mean the big C church. Christians of all times and places. So we know that night before he died, one of the things that was on Jesus' mind, and it was the subject of unity, the oneness of Christians in the world. Of all the things that Jesus could have prayed for the church, and I am sure he could have prayed for an awful lot of things for the church, but of all the things that he prayed for on that night, he prayed for Christians to be one, to be in unity. So if it's important to Jesus, then it must be important to us. And so let's understand a couple things about the unity that he was praying for. The first thing that I would point out to us is that the unity that Jesus prays for and the unity that Jesus invites us into is not primarily our unity. It is his. He invites us into his unity. Verse 21, he says, "I pray that all of them may be one, Father, just as you, Father, are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us." He's praying for the unity that he enjoys as God to be true of us. He invites us into that unity. So when we think about unity, when we think about oneness among Christians, I think we tend to think that it's all about us and what we do. You know, kind of like the image that comes to my mind is you know, you have a family going on a road trip and you've got kids in the back seats of the minivan, and, you know, unity is them trying hard to get along so that, you know, dad doesn't have to say, "Don't make me come back there." But that's not the kind of unity Jesus is praying for or inviting us into. The unity he's inviting us into is the unity that he shares as God. You know, every morning, devout Jews pray what is called the Shema. And it's in our Bibles, it comes out of Deuteronomy chapter 6. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and strength." God is one. And yet, we also believe that God is three. We sing the song sometimes, "God in three persons, blessed Trinity, Father, Son, and Spirit." God is one, and yet God is three. And Jesus says these three persons are in each other. The Father is in the Son, and the Son, the Spirit are in the Father. What some have called a community of oneness or a fellowship of divine love. Impossible to fully explain. How can God be one and yet three? I don't know that, and I'm kind of glad I don't know that, because a God that I could totally figure out and explain would not be all that impressive. But God enjoys oneness in threeness. Also inexplicable is the fact that he invites us into that oneness. And it is hard to exaggerate the magnitude of that invitation. God inviting us into his very own oneness as Father, Son, and Spirit. Probably the closest human equivalent I can think of is marriage, where, you know, we talk about two people becoming one. And if the kind of oneness that God desires for us to have with him and in him is anything like the two becoming one of marriage, then this is an incredible invitation. Now, we have to work to become one with God and each other. Just like in marriage, two don't become one just mystically or magically or overnight. It takes work, it takes effort. And so Paul, writing to Christians in Ephesus in the first century, said this. He said, make every effort to keep the unity. Make every effort. You know, you've got to work hard for this unity. But again, it is not primarily your unity. Make every effort to keep the unity of the Spirit. And then Paul goes on to talk about some of the common ground that he provides for us to have unity with each other. So he goes on and he says, there is one body and one Spirit, just as you were called to one hope when you were called, one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is over all and through all and in all. So there's a lot of oneness there that could potentially pull us together and help us be one. And so we have the good news that the foundation for the kind of oneness among us that we long for, God has provided for us in himself. And oneness is important because it's not just primarily about us, it's about him. Another thing that indicates the importance of this kind of oneness back in Jesus' prayer in John 17 is the fact that this unity is not just for our sake as Christians, not just for our sake in the church, but it's for the sake of the world. This unity is for the sake of the world. Jesus mentions that two times. In verse 21, he says, may they also be in us so that the world may believe that you have sent me. And in case you missed it the first time, Jesus prays it again. Verse 23, may they be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. Now, when we talk about our call to reach the world, we tend to focus on you know, kind of the Indiana Jones, you know, go out there and do it kind of thing. You know, it's all about the mission, and we need to get out there and we need to win people to Christ. And absolutely, we need to work hard at our calling to make disciples in the world. The interesting thing here is that Jesus suggests that just as effective and important as our going out is what's happening in here, is the oneness between us. If we want to reach the world, then it takes unity among Christians to do it. So this unity is important. But then we need to talk about what actually is this unity. What does it look like? How do we foster it? I mean, you know, hasn't time kind of shown that it just is impossible for us to be unified? I mean, you know, black and white Christians, rich and poor Christians, women and men who struggle, you know, with the oneness in marriage, much less get a whole group of them together and try to get them to be one. I mean, it seems impossible. And it must be impossible because Jesus prayed for it. But it also must be possible because he prayed for it. Now, some people will talk sometimes about the number of denominations we see in our world. And they'll say, you know, that's a sign of the disunity. I mean, you have all of these churches that kind of, you know, they can't get along, Christians can't get along, and so they break up into all of these different groups. And I would absolutely say that many splits in churches are the result of sin, and they are a terrible sign of disunity. And yet, you know, I'd also suggest to you that if we were to have some kind of gigantic merger of all churches in the world, all Christian churches, that is not necessarily the kind of unity Jesus is talking about. I mean, did you hear in the news back in the spring? There was a merger between T-Mobile and Sprint. And I don't remember hearing, you know, as the news was coming out about that, I don't remember hearing about how much these companies loved each other. Did you hear about that? I mean, you could have organizational, bureaucratic oneness. You could take the 501c3 organizations called churches and you know, unify them organizationally and still not have the kind of unity and love that Jesus talks about. And I'd suggest to you that you could not have that kind of unity and still have the kind of love that Jesus talks about. And so I want to suggest to you some places that we can start if we want to put this into practice. And the first place I'd suggest to you is just that we recognize that this unity starts with relationship one another's. That it starts with relationship one another's. You know what I mean by the one another's? You know, if you go to the New Testament writings, you know, in Jesus' time and after, you find all kinds of one another's. Love one another. Pray for one another. Be kind to one another. What if we start with unity there? What if we just, you know, make a study of the one another's, and I think by one count, there's at least 21 of them. What if we studied the one another's and said, let's focus on doing these in our relationships with each other? So unity looks like forgiving one who has hurt you. Unity looks like encouraging one who feels down or timid or weak. Unity looks like showing compassion to one who never seems to get any breaks. Unity looks like listening to one who seems to get overlooked often. Unity is confronting one who needs to hear truth from a reluctant, tearful messenger coming to them in love. Unity is bearing with one who makes you crazy. Unity is choosing to believe the best about one who you don't understand. Unity is speaking well of one rather than, you know, having a little whisper conversation with your circle of friends about, you know, what a pain they are. Imagine we had a church full of people who practiced all of these kinds of one another's. I have an idea that if we had a whole church full of people who did those kind of things all the time, that we would have an outsider, maybe many outsiders, who would look in on that and they would say, you know, I don't know if I could ever believe the kinds of things that they believe, but, you know, I wonder how they do it. And I sure wish I could be like that. Can we start there? Can we start with the one another's? Can we one another each other well? And then see where we go from there. Let me offer you some other suggestions for where we might go if we want to put unity into practice. Another suggestion is aim for wide acceptance and narrow agreement. Wide acceptance, narrow agreement. Paul, writing to Romans, Christians in Rome in the first century, talking about their differences, says this: accept one another, then, just as Christ accepted you in order to bring praise to God. And accept there means to take someone to yourself. to draw them in, to receive or welcome them, to welcome them into your space, to welcome them into your home, into your world, into your life. Just as Christ welcomed us into his relationship with the Father. Be wide in your acceptance of people. And keep your expectations narrow for your agreement on issues. Now, we often want to do the opposite, don't we? I mean, we want wide agreement. We want to all, you know, we should all agree on the issues. And then if we all agree, then we can accept each other. And I think the scriptures suggest, you know, we start with wide acceptance. And you know, we focus on a few things when we're talking about being in agreement with one another. Now, you might say, well, doesn't this church have any standards then? You know, is there never a reason for us to separate? And the scriptures do give us reasons where at times we might divide from others. You know, a few categories would be, you know, if someone is preaching a different Jesus, or if someone is preaching a different gospel message, if someone, you know, is promoting the idea that, well, God forgives, so I can just live however I want. And you confront them about that, and they're not willing to see it differently, then you might divide from them. Or you might divide from someone if they're being divisive. You know, if they consistently are talking bad about someone else, criticizing, blaming someone else, you know, creating suspicion and mistrust, if they're being divisive, then, you know, you might divide from them. But beyond that, the scriptures don't, you know, talk a whole lot about separating yourself from people. Instead, they talk about accepting, welcoming, drawing close. And that doesn't mean that you hide your differences or blunt your differences. You know, you hold on to your differences at times, and you communicate them with respect and humility. Aim for wide acceptance. Narrow agreement. Next one flows kind of out of that. Know the difference between biblical principles and personal convictions. The difference between biblical principles and personal convictions. So the Bible gives us lots of principles for wise living. If we want to live well, we can find good insight in the scriptures. But the Bible doesn't spell out how we should think and how we should act in every situation. So what happens is we who follow Jesus, we read the scriptures to get the biblical principles, and then we have to apply those principles, and out of those principles, we form some convictions and we make decisions. Well, things can get a little tricky when we read biblical principles and we read the same principles, but sometimes the convictions that we form coming out of them are different. We don't all come up with the same kind of choices coming out of the biblical principles. So let's just be clear. You know, we want to live our lives based on biblical principles, but sometimes the way we live those out will look different. Know that difference. If we don't, then it'll make unity unnecessarily harder. Next suggestion for you. And here we start to get down to some nitty-gritty, like, to-dos. Ban yourself from speaking unkindly, divisively, or slanderously of or to others. Now, in our world today, I think I probably don't need to talk about, you know, what you say in a conversation with someone as much as I need to talk about what you post online, you know, what you put on social media. Can I suggest that you refrain from posting derogatory memes, sarcastic comments, name-calling and put-downs? What if our, you know, social media usage was characterized less by those kinds of things and more by, you know, posting things like you know, some variation of these words, thank you, well done, I'm sorry, I forgive you, how can I help? What if for the next 30 days you didn't post anything on social media that was not some variation of one of those things that I just said? You might just be practicing unity. Another one, look for ways to work with other Christians outside our church. You know, a very practical thing we can do if we want to work on unity is find areas of common ground with other believers who aren't part of our church and celebrate that common ground by working together. Another one, participate in another church's worship services. You know, with online church, that is easier than ever. But what if you did what Adele Calhoun calls going for a God hunt in a church tradition that was not your own? Where is God working in another church? That doing that occasionally can be a practice of unity. Make peace with someone with whom you're at odds. You know, like Dennis the Menace and Margaret's attempt to reinvent him, unity can look better on paper than it does in practice. I mean, you know, unity as an abstract ideal is much more fun than unity in the nitty-gritty of relationships where at times we say and do things that hurt each other. But if we cannot make peace even with someone with whom we're at odds, then how can we ever make progress in unity? My last suggestion for you this morning is share the communion meal. Now, that's probably one thing that Christians of all stripes have continued to have in common over the generations. And we believe different things about what the meal represents, but all Christians in some form or another celebrate the communion meal. And we want to do that this morning as the ultimate unifier. We want to recognize the price that the Trinity paid to bring us into their oneness. Jesus hanging on the cross, separating himself from the intimacy that he had enjoyed with Father and Spirit. And we do that through communion. Worship team, I'm going to invite you to come now. If by faith you have entered that invisible oneness of Father, Son, and Spirit, and to the best of your ability, you are seeking to live at one with other believers, we welcome you to share in this time of communion. The worship team is going to share with us a song. And as we listen, it's a time to prepare our hearts and to prepare our elements both here and at home, and then after the song, we'll share together.